Welcome to The Virtual Shift, a show looking at the seismic changes happening in healthcare with virtual care at the epicenter. Join me and my guests as we look at key cultural and policy shifts impacting how providers, payers, and patients connect, as well as how care is being reimagined both for today and the future. Hello, and thanks for tuning in today. I'm your host, Tom Foley. You can learn more about this show by visiting the program on healthcarenowradio.com, and be sure to follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter, at FoleyTom. And the hashtag, The Virtual Shift. Hello, thanks for joining us today. My name is Tom Foley. I'm the host of The Virtual Shift. And I have with me today Dr. Joshua Landy. He is the CMO at Figure One. Doctor, welcome to the program.
Hello, thanks, Tom.
Awesome. So, Doctor, tell me a little bit about yourself and what you're currently involved in relative to virtual care.
Sure. So I am a practicing physician. I'm a general internist sometimes, and I'm a critical care physician other times. I guess with the pandemic just passing us, it's been a heavy year of critical care. Relearning a lot of stuff that I surprised myself needing to relearn, which we'll talk about, I think. And in my spare time of what I have, I started a company called Figure One a few years ago, which is an online platform that lets doctors and healthcare professionals share medical cases and talk about them online in a sort of way to support each other.
Interesting. So we might dive a little bit into that, into this conversation. So, you know, COVID has really shifted the thought of clinical care delivery. All right. Everybody thought it was the automatic de facto. I got to go to the brick and mortar. Right. Schedule an appointment. Wait 3 weeks. Get the appointment. Spend only 5-10 minutes in front of the doctor and out the door you go. Right. So I hate to shorten it, but that's ultimately the experience of the patient. So what have you learned during COVID? You're in the thick of it. What have you learned in COVID? And when you talk about things that you had to re-educate yourself on, but just in general relative to delivery of care practices.
So I've learned 5 years worth of stuff in both of my jobs this year. So I work in medicine from both sides. I work in medicine in the clinical side, like a, you know, like a regular old, you know, ICU doc. And I also work in medicine building a medical education platform that helps teach physicians. And so I was able to see huge shifts both in the way that we were working and the sort of support I needed as a doc. But I also started to see the sort of things other doctors were experiencing and sort of getting a sense of like what that was like en masse through my work at the tech company. So, for example, the pandemic brought us new loads of cases with respiratory distress like I haven't seen before in my career. You learn about treating these patients with ARDS, and you do a lot of work in fellowship. And then you get to the community, which is where I've worked for the past 10 years, and you see a few cases every year. And you're like, I'm glad I remember how to do that. And then 1 year, there, instead of being 2 or 4 cases that year that you see, there is, you know, 10 cases a day. And you have to double your shift, so you're now working, you know, said more than 75% of the days in the month, and you're seeing more than 10 times the amount of cases you ever saw of this specific type of lung disease. And you start to appreciate, now that everyone has the same disease, you can appreciate subtleties within that disease that you can't appreciate when you're only seeing 2 cases a year. And so you start to appreciate, A, how skilled are the people who deal with ARDS every day, and you also realize how much better you got at your job by just working on the same thing over and over again. So that was a really, really interesting experience for me, because now we're starting to fade away and the cases aren't as high. And so, you know, I'm sort of like juggling these new skills in my hand saying, oh yeah, aren't we going to go around and check the Delta P on these people's ventilators today?
Yeah. So, how did the virtual care aspect influence your delivery of care?
So, I don't practice critical care by telemedicine. I used to. That was a very interesting time in my life, and I can only imagine what that was like through a pandemic. But on the side where Figure One plays in, which maybe is what you mean by virtual care. We were seeing people participating and helping educate each other in a community. And that is the exact sort of behavior that we've seen. I mean, we've seen hundreds of times on Figure One, but that's where the community shines, where you've got a problem where almost everyone in the world knows that it's a problem, and a few people are going to have experience, and those people are going to share those experiences, revealing the solutions to other people who haven't seen these problems yet. And so the discussions about cytokine storm and treating COVID with interleukin receptor antibodies, we had that conversation on Figure One like the third week of the pandemic, because we had a rheumatologist who was willing to do and ask me anything, and she just talked about this as one of the possible therapies. And 9 months later, there I was ordering it on every single one of my patients.
Interesting. So that's a tool that physicians use in order to collaborate and the back end of the delivery of care, if you will, right? So what do you see missing or lacking on the provider side equation from a technology perspective to support them in a virtual care model?
This is such an interesting question, Tom. There has been so much movement in the consumer space for health and wellness, and there's been a lot of production of tools on the doctor side, but not a lot of like constructive tools. There's a lot of tools. There's hundreds of them. Everyone is looking at. I get 30 emails a week. Someone looking to sell me a telemedicine solution. None of them are the solution. There are millions of solutions. We have not consolidated what we need as healthcare professionals, and that's partially an economic problem and partially a product research problem.
So talk to me a little bit more about that. So so there's a lot of stuff out there, as I always say. You know, HIMSS is coming up, right? So you step on the HIMSS floor and, you know, you have to ask yourself a lot of questions relative to what's your piece of that pie, if you will, right? So are you saying that the market is still too fragmented and doesn't really have a cohesive answer, an integrated answer relative to what physicians need?
I think that the market, people I speak to who are in that market, conceptualize this as there is something we can describe as what physicians need, and it's a thing that we can build. And the problem is that there isn't a thing that physicians need. There are 1,000 jobs that physicians do, and we call it practicing medicine, and it needs 1,000 different tools because each person does it a slightly different way in a slightly different clinic, right? Like, you can't tell the registration clerk in the emergency department to use the same software as the ICU doc, as the nurse who's delivering chemotherapy in the chemo suite. Like, hello.
Well, you're hitting on a key fact, and that is that I don't know if you were around when high tech hit in the U.S. In the context of adoption of health information technology (EHRs). You know, the number one challenge at the time were twofold. One, they adopted technology, but the technology wasn't really flexible enough to be customized to each individual workflow of that setting, right? To your point, so that was the number one challenge. So you're kind of repeating that challenge here in the virtual world, even 11 years later, about it's still about technology, and the technology still isn't, one, flexible enough to meet the individual needs of the provider and or the respective setting. So we've come a long way in health IT, in my belief, but we still have some hurdles to address in the context of what does it take truly to transform the delivery of care. Would you agree? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think you're right. There's probably, I would imagine, two large waves, which sort of represent like the two humps you have to traverse before you can enter the new realm of amazing digital healthcare. The first is you have to put all the words on computers. And so this has been something that's been happening. I watched part of this happen while I was in med school. All our textbooks went from books to what we called PDAs, right? Personal Digital Assistants at the time. And I had all my textbooks on my PDA, and I had a little Bluetooth keyboard, and I would try to type notes in class. And the technology was terrible, but you could read it. You could read it, you could search for stuff, and it worked. Okay, so then we wait 15 years while everything sort of goes online. And now, they're not called papers because people read them online mostly. They're called papers because they were on paper. We still call them that. And we're getting there. But the sun has still not set on the paper world for hump number one. Hump number two is much harder than hump number one. So good luck to us. Hump number two is where we take the interactions that we have and we put those in the digital world too. And so while it's easier to retype something or scan something and use software to convert it to a text file, that's one level of difficulty. But creating a platform where people can interact and you can manifest actions and activity and therapy and diagnosis through a digital medium, that's layers more complicated than the first thing. And we're not even done the first thing yet.
We're not done the first thing yet, but I think you're leaning in on artificial intelligence, if I were to, because you're talking about a bunch of data. I'll step back. My father, he had many comorbidities as a relation to obesity, right? So, the last 5 years of his life, he lost both legs and an arm and a couple fingers on the other hand. So, diabetes doesn't hurt until the amputations begin. But the point there being is, if he was in rehab for his first leg, and the doctor walked into the room, and this is in 96, so the book was about yay big on him. And he starts flipping through the pages, right? And I was like, there's no way he's reading it because he's flipping that fast. And so, it's just, to me, I relate that to what you just said, is that there's still a lot of stuff in an EHR, but to glean history and bring it to the forefront to the current complaint is not there. At least it may be there in some EHRs, but there's still a lot of, if it was there, then we wouldn't need all this artificial intelligence that we talk about. But the point there being is artificial intelligence takes the full longitudinal view, mm-hmm. and brings it to the forefront in a summarized way. Would you agree to that? What are your thoughts on that?
So I think when you start working with machine learning and artificial intelligence, you gain the ability to get answers that you never thought you would ever get. The problem is the questions become a lot harder to ask because now you have the entire scope of that whole chart and, 30 other reams of other data from other sources, which are also in there. And now it gets harder to ask a question. Is this patient's coronary artery disease improving? Well, you used to be able to there used to be two or three data points. You would go through, you check their cholesterol, you'd see if they're, if they were having symptoms, you check their blood pressure. Okay, done. Now you want to use AI machine learning. You're going to dip into tens of thousands of data points. Well, I hope you know how to make sense of that and know exactly what question to ask, while the answers get easier, the questions get harder is what I mean.
Interesting. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Virtual Shift. I'm your host, Tom Foley, and we're talking with Dr. Joshua Landry, CMO of Figure One. So interesting what you just said, because it kind of leans into, we talk about a little bit about brick and mortar care is where we started the conversation, but relative to your background. We talked a little bit about virtual care. Virtual care is a very broad statement in the context, again, is it just video or more? And then we talked about AI. So and what still might be missing, because I think we're just in the beginnings of applying AI across the ecosystem to deliver that that ideal care model. So the point there being is, where does remote patient monitoring come into play? Right, I got a lot of data flowing. Right, I put you on that program because of a particular chronic condition or multiple chronic conditions. I gave you a specific device. but doesn't mean that there might not be other things developing, one. But I got a lot of data flowing, so I'm going to look at it in a narrow view of why it was prescribed.
Right.
Thoughts on that?
Sure. Making sure that you're using the right tool for the right job is a really important task, especially when, like you said, there's a lot of stuff out there. Making sure that you are pulling the right thing off the shelf and saying, this is going to give me information I need to solve the problem, or this tool is going to solve the problem. Those are the only two acceptable reasons for deploying something on your patients, no matter how easy it is compared to how hard it used to be, right? Making sure that you're getting data that you know how to use. There's lots of good indications for home monitoring, but as we get close to, like, there are lots of wearables out there looking for a medical application, and because there's telemonitor, you know, there's distance monitoring in medicine, this is sort of a distance monitoring in wellness. Like, there's a lot of anxiety about, can we merge these fields and get these, you know, get all these smartwatches monitoring people's heart rates? Let's use that data for something. Like, yeah. Okay, sure. Tell me what.
Yeah, and I hear you on the wearables, but let's make sure from a remote patient monitoring perspective in a billable scenario, it needs to be an FDA cleared device. So, sure. So the wearable to me is, if it's not FDA cleared, is more of a precursor to, and probably more of self-monitoring than it is clinical monitoring. But that said, I don't discount wearables, because I think it does have a valued place in the entire ecosystem, because again, we want our patients to be on a continuum of awareness to wellness, right? They don't, awareness isn't raised until they learn more, right? And to your point earlier, yeah, I started engaging something, and I, you know, even your own awareness from a clinical perspective changed because you saw repeated occurrences of a clinical condition and the nuances of it as you went by. So to me, the patient has to do the same thing. But the point there being is, I got all the, again, I got to go back to data. I got this data flowing from my wearables, from my medical devices. But you know what you're talking about is, you know, and we talked about AI. So clinical decision support tool. I always believe that I, as a patient, need a clinical decision support tool as well as the physician, because the physician isn't always available to me. I need some help. I need a coach, right? So what do you see clinical decision support expanding into the realm of consumerism?
I think there's room in the market for it. How easy is it to build is a great question. How are you going to collect enough? How are you going to collect the evidence to show that it works? Is it going to be like an important problem? Like, these problems may be larger than the scope of I just want to mention, Tom, that one of the hardest parts that I have with clinical decision support as a doctor is that it's been hard to build something that automatically knows what you want to know at the right time, right? That's something that I would say is not currently technologically feasible.
Yeah. Do you think that there's regulatory constraints on the use of clinical decision support, and should we look at adjusting some regulatory constraints? And here's the reason why. I got a blood pressure cuff on, right? Mm-hmm. Remote patient monitor, and I got to measure myself 16 times in a given month, right? Where I'm measuring my glucose, right? And I have my own personal ranges as to where my blood pressure should be and my glucose should be. If it goes outside that range, then that's the alert. But they're not. So what a one-off alert might just be that I ate a jelly donut when I shouldn't have, and that's a problem, right? So as long as I don't do that on a day-to-day basis, I'm good. I should be okay. But the point there being is, when does clinical support from a consumer's perspective help coach that patient that says your blood pressure is too high and I think you need to see a doctor? Because that's ultimately what happens. Hey, your blood pressure is too high, go see a doctor. They're not coached other than anything else than make the call, right? But at the same time, there could be more that could help that patient in the context of what are some of the norms in how to lower your blood pressure, diet, exercise, right? You know, stop arguing with your spouse. Those types of things, right?
Yeah.
I was at the doctor's yesterday, and I was talking while she was taking the blood pressure. She said, stop talking. It increases your blood pressure. So it's like, okay, I stopped talking.
Oh, yeah. Tell them, if you want to ride, you should read the instructions on how to take someone's blood pressure according to the blood pressure guidelines. It's like a 15-minute procedure to take blood pressure, and there are instructions, and they take time and care to get a good blood pressure reading. So it doesn't surprise me that it's hard to do while someone's riding a bus and yelling at their spouse or whatever.
So again, tell me a little bit more about clinical decision support. What does the provider, where are we at from a provider side, and where do you think we need to go from a consumer side?
So to get to a consumer-sided decision support tool, and I mean a true decision, so I'm talking, it's going to measure your blood pressure and your blood sugar or whatever, and you're going to get a notification, and it's going to give you an instruction. Like, that is what I'm talking about. Does that make sense? Are we on the same page?
That makes sense. Right. That makes sense. So, but the FDA would say, hey, you just made a clinical decision.
Yeah, of course.
So that's where my regulatory hack comes on and says, hey, that just went over the top on a regulatory basis. And that's where I think there's some constraints there.
There are.
Right. So I'm looking at it now from a provider side. What would a provider say if they relied on an AI tool to tell their clients, their patients, what to do next if things went out of whack?
I think it's a challenge. I'm not confident that it's something that will easily exist in a way that it can access the broad market. This is with the technology we have today. It's possible there's with better sensors in the future, sure. But in order to convince the FDA, you're going to have to measure tens of thousands of these instances and show that, like, with instruction A, with instruction A, you get this type of outcome. With instruction B, you get this type of outcome. And how many people listen to the instructions? That's the real, that's another question. And then look at the outcomes and see if you're actually helping people's health move forward. It's going to take a lot of expensive research to change policy. But if you do it for the right reason, the results can be astounding.
Yeah. I would agree. To me, at the end of the day, this is about how to get healthy, how to get that patient on that path to wellness, with the physician being the core coach, and with some tools that can help supplement that. Because the ultimate challenge here is that we have a growing population, an aging population, a sicker population. And we have less doctors and nurses available to take care of an older, aging, sicker population. So that's, in my view, that's the core macro trends that we need to deal with. So how does care change with that as the backdrop, right? That's why virtual care, because COVID took brick and mortar away from people.
Yeah.
So and that's where virtual care stepped in, right? It was once a nice to have, now seemingly a must have. But there's still more to get done. Your thoughts?
Yeah. Well, I'd love to see decision support support the decisions that doctors have to make, so that doctors can spend more time talking to their patients or hearing them out. Like, build something that helps doctors do prior authorizations, right? Like, no doc wants to spend their clinic time on the phone with an insurance company. Build something that takes that away completely. Build something that takes away all the jobs that aren't like doing medicine on patients. And then you are going to have the sweetest, kindest doctors who will be able to access knowledge that part of their, tool set has already accessed for them. That's what you want in a clinician experience. Be able to focus on the work that's meaningful, which is spending time with your patients and helping them solve their problems.
Which is the biggest complaint with EHRs from a patient perspective and a doctor's perspective? Too many times the head is down, hands on keyboard, and not enough face time having that one-on-one interaction about the most important thing that meeting is about, and that's about the patient's well-being.
Yeah, like, let's measure that. Why not use that as an outcome measure when you're testing these tools? How much time was the doctor able to spend with the patient as a result of this alleged speed-up tool?
And at the end of the day, they're asked to do more using technology, which is taking away critical time with the patient. Because again, they gotta meet the regulatory guidelines of what was entered and things of that nature. So we still have a long way to go. Technology is still, I still say that we're coming out of phase one of health IT adoption, right? I think with COVID, sad to say, but encouraging, is that it took a pandemic to force a market change. And I think that this is where a lot of innovation is coming to the forefront to help both the doctors and the patients. Closing word from you, doctor?
We need loads more innovation. I don't think that we're nearing the solution yet. I think we're not converging yet, but I think people are getting smarter and they're making better tools than they were 5 years ago. So, you know, when I see you at HIMSS the year after next, hopefully we'll see lots of different stuff than we even saw this year. You know, I think these things will converge as people learn more about what the tools need to do and what technology is built in order to be able to help us with it. So here's hoping that we get not only the space back, but we get a bit more time back to spend between doctors and patients.
Fair enough. We'll leave it there until next time. Dr. Landry, I appreciate your time. I would like to thank the show sponsors, both HP and Intel. HP Engage long lifecycle products provide the stability, safety, and security you need, plus flexibility and performance designed for today and tomorrow. As well, Intel would like you to know we're going above and beyond together with new standards for business with the latest Intel vPro processors, delivering what IT needs for performance, security, remote manageability, and stability. And be sure to check out the program page on healthcarenowradio.com. And remember, connect or follow me on LinkedIn, Twitter, at Foley Tom, and follow the show's hashtag, The Virtual Shift. I'm Tom Foley. Until the next shift.